Welcome to The Barbell Strikes Back. I'm your host, James McDermott, and joining me today is Adam Shiner. Adam is a fellow weightlifter and a film director. Previously, he produced an incredible short film called The Artist and the Olympian, which starred Donnie Schenkel. Currently, he is in the process of creating the first feature-length film of the sport of weightlifting called The Weight. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate that you're reaching out.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you. You know, I'm, of course, a big fan of weightlifting, and I'm a huge film and movie buff. You know, it's that's like my second passion, so I want to hear all about the ins and outs of you and film and these projects that you've worked on. But first, let's dive into a little bit of your background on weightlifting. How did you get into the sport? Who's your coach? What events have you done? Let's talk about Adam, the weightlifter.
Well, there's not as much there to say. I've only actually done one competition, but I got into Olympic weightlifting. My first experience with any of the movements, really, like a lot of people, was playing football in high school. You know, we were taught the power clean. This, and I don't think we were even taught the snatch. It was just the hanging kind of power clean. It wasn't until I went to college, and this is around 2006. You know, I was an athlete growing up, and that's all I wanted to be. And I also loved film, of course. And I kind of realized I had a natural talent there. But I, through a friend, got involved in CrossFit in the very, very early days. It was at CrossFit Boston, was my first kind of weightlifting class, you know, with PVC, with Neil Thompson. And then I joined a gym called CrossFit Center City, and I've never had an official coach, but if I had to say, like, who was my one coach, it was a woman named Erin Davidson, now Erin Farmer, who at the time owned CrossFit Center City. And she was really great. You know, I was, you know, a 19-year-old kid when I started learning the movements, really. And like every young man, I was trying to go too heavy and everything else. And she was really focusing on technique. And I wish I listened to her more. But in terms of my own lifting, I've really been, self-taught for the most part, you know, and just following different programs. I was very lucky, you know, as I was learning weightlifting, I was also in film school and got really interested in it and was talking to, I was talking to Glenn Pendlay at the time, just doing research. I didn't have a coach, but I was talking to Glenn and other coaches. So I had a pretty good, you know, group of people who I shouldn't have been talking to or shouldn't have been, like, teaching me some tips.
It's a great group.
Yeah, it's a pretty good group for a guy that at the time was probably snatching 70 kilos and not even clean and jerking 200 pounds. I was a pretty decent CrossFitter. But I really didn't have the time to develop into the weightlifter I wanted to be. There was really one time in, my life where I exclusively trained very hard in weightlifting. And that was when, after we did the Artist Olympian, I was, you know, we were told we needed to do a sizzle reel, by a producer I was working with at the time. And we had a weightlifter that was going to be, you know, they were going to film with, and he got hurt. And so it was, you know, I had no money at the time. So I was like, you know what? I don't lift the weights, but I actually have decent technique for the fact that I don't, you know, I the weights aren't what they should be, but we can fake that, with a little bit of movie magic, and we can make this work. So I probably trained for 12 weeks for that one competition. We filmed at Hook Grip Spartakiad. So I was like, we'll save money. It'll be me. It was myself, my DP, who's the DP for the feature film, and my brother, who's an assistant camera guy. And there was the three of us kind of filming that little sizzle reel. And obviously I was competing. So my first competition, I went 86-106, which is, people, you know, think I'm strong. They're in the film industry and they think I'm this weightlifter guy. I have to tell them, I have pretty decent competitive numbers for the lightest weight class on the female side. You know,
hey, those aren't bad numbers at all. I mean, it's like, I mean, you've been in the community for quite some time, 2006. So that's pretty cool. And you said you've only done one weightlifting meet, but you know what? The old saying is, you know, to call yourself a weightlifter, you have to do one meet. So you are a weightlifter.
Well, thank you.
And those are good numbers. I mean, like, do you ever hope to build upon those numbers, do another meet in the future, strap on the shoes again?
So this is something I talk about with Zach a lot. I'm like, my biggest thing is after this movie is done, I want to be able to have the time to kind of train full time. I've always wanted to snatch 100 kilos. In training, I've done 95. And in terms of clean jerk, you know, I kind of want to do at some point before I die, you know, like 140. You know, I think those are, you know, kind of everyone has similar, you know, markers they want to hit. And
yeah, those are fantastic goals.
Yeah. So that's, I would like to do that. I would like to, you know, squat 200 kilos. Ironically enough, I'm 6'2". So I'm pretty tall and I'm, you know, built to pull. I'm not really, I have a terrible, the difference between my back squat and my, deadlift is over 150 pounds. I've actually, when I was training after the competition, I just wanted to kind of test it out where I was. And I doubled 500 pounds while having a 155 back squat. Wow. Or you know, a 335 back squat or whatever it was. 227 kilo deadlift, you'd say.
Yeah, so you definitely are a puller.
Yeah, it was. It's pretty insane. Obviously, my positions are so different. That was, you know, that I pulled that, you know, I doubled 500. I had not pulled more than 300 at the time. I was just focusing, but I was focusing on position versus when I did cross and stuff like that, where, you know, my pull was significantly different in a deadlift more than a clean deadlift. And I think just doing all that position work and squatting more often, it really strengthened my legs, where before I think I was all back, you know, stronger legs, better technique. And, you know, without even touching that weight for years, it kind of, the first rep kind of surprised me because it flew up, and the second rep I probably shouldn't have done, but you know, I wasn't jeopardizing a career in weightlifting at that point, so I was like, it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's you're feeling good, it's in training, you just have the bar in your hands and you're like, you know what, I'm going for another one. I think that's a brave thing to do. Like, it's like, normally, like, everyone goes in, like, if someone's doing 500 for the first time or just in general, like, all right, I want to get one, you know, unless you're like really confident in it. And I don't think many people hit a lift and while the weight is still in their hands decide, I'm going for another one, like right now. You know, normally it's a pre-thought thing.
I would advise against it. I mean, me and Zach have had this conversation a lot about people training smart versus, you know, obviously in the Artisan Olympian, it's a guy doing the same thing over and over again. And I think you get like a day like that, you know, a day every once in a while. Mentally, you need that, but in terms of like actual consistent training, you always want to leave a little bit in reserve.
Yeah, it can't be an everyday thing. Is no. He your coach now, or is he gonna be your coach, Zach, after the film?
No, I don't think so. It's he was shot. You know, he hasn't really seen me lift. Actually, that's the funniest thing. The only time I think Zach has ever seen me lift, we've done one workout together where we were just like a front squat workout together when I was with him in Chicago. We were filming some test stuff. And then when we were at the Arnold, you know, he was like, you know, warming up with like 70 kilos. And I had not moved or worked out in like a week. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to jump in real quick. I'm like, you know, I just did a quick, you know, power clean and like probably one of the better jerks I've ever done in my life. And like, I think him and you know, his lifters were like shocked because I set the expectations very low before I touched the bar. I was like, this is gonna be the worst jerk you've ever seen. And for some reason I like nailed it that day. And I was like, I'm gonna stop here. One rep's good for the week and, I'm gonna move on. But I think, you know, after this is all done, I think I would, you know, obviously I would like to go back to lifting and I'm sure he'll comment on stuff. You know, if I can have the time and afford a coach, I would definitely go to a coach and recommend everyone does.
Definitely. Now, just to kind of backtrack a little bit, when you were doing research, you know, years ago, and you were talking to Glenn and other coaches, what kind of things were they telling you? Like, were you doing research on technique and Glenn was telling you to work from positions or things on programming? What kind of research was involved?
It was less that. It was more about getting to know people, you know, how the inner workings of the sport, the kind of behind the scenes stuff that no one talks about. Obviously, we would talk about steroids, but we'd also just talk about the types of characters of people who do this professionally in America and overseas. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, the physiological stuff and some really sciencey things, because I do have a minor in cognitive neuroscience from Temple University, which makes me sound much smarter than I am. But you know, me and Glenn would talk about that stuff because, you know, he had a master's. There was really just a lot of it was me interviewing them and just asking them why they do this. And what their kind of relationship to the barbell, and just kind of getting inside their heads and kind of finding out what the emotions were behind it.
How did that play into when you're, you know, planning the artist and the Olympian? How does knowing their mindset, all these collective thoughts, play into a film and what you're trying to bring out of your subjects in the film? Is that why you're researching it, so you can get in the mindset so that when you're behind the camera, you know what to say to them or how to coax something out of them?
That's part of it. You know, obviously a big part of, you know, because I've written everything myself as well, naturally what happens when you're writing and directing is a lot of you subconsciously or subconsciously, most often subconsciously, goes into it. So I think when I had written the story for The Weight, which was preceded the short, there was, I think a lot of my questions were trying to validate what I had in the script at the time, that, you know, this idea of writing a kind of a Renaissance type person, a Renaissance man, was authentic into who these people were. So I remember I was talking to a coach named Jim Rutter, and this is a very early concept of the script that has since changed dramatically. But I was like, you know, I have this idea of him being like an art critic or, you know, philosophy guy on top of weightlifting. I'm like, but I don't know, is that realistic? And I was talking to Jim. Jim Rutter is literally an art critic. He reviews ballets in Philadelphia, you know, and has that, went to school for philosophy. So it was like, oh crap, like this is, I was pretty straight on. So a lot of it was me trying to validate and not put too much of my story and everything else into being inauthentic into the weightlifting world. So that was a lot of my stuff. And then a lot of it was just, you know, I didn't understand how USAW, IWF, and that all relates with it, you know, the backstage politics and everything else that goes into that.
Yeah, that's incredibly important stuff to know. And that's cool that you did that research. You know, I know, you know, I'll read stories about directors and actors doing extensive research for a part or for their film and talking to people and going and experiencing things, you know, that it seems like it's a really cool part of the job. You know, is that something you learned from your film background, or is it just something that you do? Let's dive into a little bit about how you got into film. Is that something you went to college for? What drew you to that profession?
So, you know, I think everything else in my life, you know, my older brother's, he's 5 years older than me. And really as a kid, I you know, did and still look up to him as like my hero. So he was always, you know, I grew up, especially on comedy, you know, my dad's a movie buff. We grew up on Saturday Night Live, Conan O'Brien, The Simpsons writers. My brother kind of went into comedy, and I was trying to follow in his footsteps. And I kind of naturally found out that in high school, you know, I was lucky enough to go to high school. We actually had a TV studio, and I found out like that was kind of naturally where, you know, I understood things about like, you know, where the camera's supposed to be and when, why, at a very early age, where as an athlete, I was not as naturally talented and had to work really, really hard. So I got started, in high school, really. And then I did go to film school at Temple University. And that's where I kind of got delved into more serious stuff and kind of away from comedy a bit.
Did you do stand-up?
I've done stand-up once. I did more improv. Okay. I would say the scariest thing in the world, other than, you know, being, you know, the first time you go out, you know, in a weightlifting meet, you know, your very first one, and you realize everyone's eyes are on you. the only thing that has been as nerve-wracking or scary for the first time was doing stand-up. And it was terrifying, and I got through it, and I got a few laughs, but I was like, I never want to do this again. I like writing. I like improv because you have other people that you can, you know, riff off of and play with. Stand-up definitely scared the crap out of me, but
I imagine that's a goal of mine to do someday, just to try it once. What was it, like a 5-minute set or something like that?
Yeah, it was like a 5-minute set. I was at this place called the Raven Lounge in Philadelphia, which is kind of, there's two big clubs. It's, you know, Helium is really the big club in Philadelphia that a lot of bigger names will play with. And then the Raven Lounge is has a small kind of back room thing where it's, you know, open mic a lot of nights. And you get a lot of people going in there. They're just telling like kind of old school, like, here's a joke. You know, it's kind of like old school, like I'm actually telling jokes. And yeah. I was very much into Zach Galifianakis and, you know, more austere comedy that was happening at, you know, at the time. And so like I went on stage and did like these odd knock knock jokes kind of, but I would also like, you know, every comedian comes up and they have like their notebook with their set. And so like I came up and I was just like, all right, jokes. And then I read the paper and I'm like, it's a food order. And I realize, you know, it's like kind of stuff like that. That's kind of like, you're not sure if it's real or the guy's joking, but done poorly. And I just remember this one guy like thought it was kind of funny, and he was, you know, a drunk kind of, he's a weird old guy that were, you know, might have been a homeless. And it was just like a really hard laughter, and it got kind of quiet. It was very, I will always remember what that feeling was like of just the quietness after that and being like, oh my God, this is terrifying.
Yeah. Do you feel that doing that stand-up helped a little bit when you went out on the stage for your first weightlifting meet? Like you were a little less nervous because you're like, I've been through worse.
I think so. I think with the weightlifting meet also, what would help me was the fact that I was also very I was directing as I was competing. So a big part of me was just like thinking, you know, I was up there and, you know, I'm worried. I'm like, all right, I got to make this lift because we need to get at least one lift of me making, you know, I need to make at least one snatch so that we can use it. And I was like looking where my DP was and when he was filming. So it was a little less nerve wracking. I'm not sure if it helped or not. I think it you know what, it did. I think any experience, no matter what, where you are, if it's similar, will carry over somewhat. So it's less scary the second time. So yeah, it did help.
Cool. Well, that's, I mean, you're a brave guy. I mean, it's not everyone can do that, you know, and, anyone's listening, it's a good goal to have. I feel like if you can get through that and that peer pressure and that's like the ultimate of public speaking. I feel, you know, everyone's always nervous about public speaking and classes and stuff. Well, going out on a stage for 5 minutes and having to fill that whole 5 minutes, like you said, it has to be nerve wracking.
Absolutely. And I think people kind of don't appreciate how, you know, like I was telling someone, I'm like, Dave Chappelle is one of the best orators we've ever had in the history of America. Like, to be able to go up there and be comfortable and everything else, I don't think people realize it takes years and years and years to be that comfortable to make it feel like, you know, and this is also part of the craft, is it if you make it feel like you're just having a conversation with the audience.
Yeah.
That takes years of confidence.
Like a modern day philosopher now. Like he went from being like just a stand-up, and now the way he just speaks and he's having, like you said, that conversation, he's like a modern day Socrates, where you would come to see him and everyone's in the theater and he's just talking about something and there's jokes in there and it's funny, but he uses those jokes to layer in an important message. And it's just very interesting, very, very skillful.
Yeah. It's absolutely, it's one of a kind. It really is what he's able to do.
So you graduate from college, you've got a degree in film and a minor in nerves. Where do you go from there? How do you start work in this industry and start to build a project?
So I was very lucky. I actually started working while I was in college. My first paid job was on a commercial when I was 19 years old. Little bit of nepotism. I was able to get like production assistant work because my brother was working in Philadelphia at the time on commercials, and that was really where there was a lot of, you know, work in Philadelphia, you know, scripted TV and stuff like that really was very rare. You know, it's like every time M. Night Shyamalan made a movie, you know, people would go work on it. But, you know, if he wasn't there, like, you know, it was all commercials. After film school, I took an internship in New York City working on a film called Arbitrage, with working in the art department with a woman named Beth Mickle, who has been kind of instrumental in my career as well. Beth is, at the time, you know, did more independent stuff. She'd actually just finished working on Drive, so we got to see a lot of behind the scenes footage of the film Drive before anyone else did.
That's pretty cool.
Which was really cool. And she was someone that, you know, she had done a lot of big stuff, but she really took a lot of time. Her and her husband, Russell, who's also a production designer, who I'm trying to get to be our production designer on The Wait, really took me under their wing and were extremely kind to me. And you know, it's one thing when you're doing an internship. Like a lot of times, you know, people do internships and they get crap work and they never really learn what they want to learn. Beth and Russell took time on their off days to help me get more work. Like, you know, help me get work, 'cause at that time, you know, interns really weren't paid. It isn't like it is now. And I was doing 15, 16 hour days trying to learn everything I could on that stuff. And then on the weekends, every once in a while, I'd get like a gig, like painting, you know, like it wasn't even like I was painting set walls. I was painting like the dressing rooms for actors and thinking, oh, like, you know, it was just me a lot of times. Beth and Russell would show up and help me out and talk to me and really teach me and you know, kind of apprentice me a little bit. And they let me crash at their place when they were away, like, you know, stuff like that. That was really, I'm not sure if everyone does that. In this industry, especially, really, that's an extremely rare thing to have people be that kind who are that high up, and take the time to teach you. But I worked after college for around 2 years in New York working on kind of independent films, stuff that was like $12 million to $3 million. And from there, I think it was after my last week on the last film I worked in New York, I worked over 120 hours. I did a 27-hour day, day and a half. Huh. And I was completely burned out. And I think that week I barely cleared like $700 because they paid crap. And I was like, I'm never going to work this hard on a film that's not mine. Especially when I didn't, you know, the film I had worked on wasn't very good. It wasn't like it was this high artistic thing. It was a kind of a crap movie. So after that, I moved home to Philadelphia. And that's when I wrote the first draft of The Wait. And took it to my one friend from film school. And at that time, you know, she had a relationship with Lionsgate through her uncle. And, you know, she kind of pitched it to someone at Lionsgate. And they wanted to buy the outline for like $30,000. But I would, you know, have no say in the script. I would have no say in directing or doing anything else. So oddly enough, as I was about to tell her I was going to turn it down, she stopped working for them and started working for this other producer. And it went away. But I realized, I'm like, if I'm going to let me direct this, I have to do a short film. And that's when The Artist in Olympian happened. And after that, I was broke and I took a job, working on reality TV, with my brother on a show called, Restaurant Impossible, which I had also worked on in college as well.
That sounds familiar. Who starred in that?
Robert Irvine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's like the jacked guy, right?
Yeah. Robert. Okay. Oh, I have plenty of funny stories about him just because he's bodybuilding and I was I would work out with him in the mornings. And one day I didn't have my weightlifting shoes and I brought dress shoes because, you know, it has a heel and yeah. I was squatting everything out. And he was always like, yeah, you're going to tear yourself apart or something like that. And I was like trying to explain to him how it all works because he didn't care. And, but he always, every time I see him, he just always liked to tell people about the dress shoes because he thinks it's the funniest in the world.
Is he a pretty strong guy?
He's an older guy and he's pretty strong. I would say no. I'll say
because he looks strong. Like he's a
he
big
looks strong. Guy. He's bodybuilder strong. You know, he can, you know, he would bench like, you know, 225 for 10 very easily. But, you know, he's never done a deadlift in his life, never squatted.
Oh, okay. You know, see, I wondered about that. That was going to be my next question. Does he do leg day? Because he always wears those really tight black shirts that, like,
No.
Go off his arms.
He does not. I don't think he's maybe he's done some few leg extensions. I would join in with him. My good friend is his assistant still. And, you know, I would join with them when they started hitting arms, or if they hit, you know, they were doing like lat pull downs or stuff like that. I would join in because that stuff was really good. It was, you know, I learned some bodybuilding tricks from him. But in terms of overall strength, no. And I don't think he liked that stuff very much.
I see. Yeah, I always wondered that watching the show because, like, you know, the Food Network's one of the best channels. You know, he'd go on there and just watch hours of food competitions and shows like that one. So he'd be one of the ones I would always watch. I'm like, I wonder how much this guy can squat or bench or deadlift. And
Well, he doesn't. He also, you know, he's got some injuries. He has an artificial hip right now. But he's I did not, you know, we kind of rubbed against each other the wrong way in the beginning. And then, you know, years later, I like him a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, I met my wife on that show. I got to travel around. I worked in every single continental state and I got to really bond with my brother. I drove a 26-foot box truck cross country because, you know, in between shows, you know, all the film gear and everything else, you know, it's too expensive to ship. So they hired, you know, you get four people, two to a vehicle, two people would drive this 26-foot box truck, and two people would drive the Lexus SUV from place to place, which is a very different experience in drive.
Yeah.
You know, but I got to drive with my brother and one of my best friends, who's actually the editor for the Weight. You know, a lot of the work I actually, you know, have been talking about and the creative aspects of it would happen with me and my friend Rick Chapman driving cross country in this 26-foot box truck, talking about the movie and just talking about, you know, every film imaginable, because we're both huge nerds. So it was really one of a kind experience. And I did that for around a year and a half. And then I moved to LA, where I was trying to get the film, you know, kind of funded and stuff. Like, I was really working on the script then. With my buddy Chris Devlin, who is actually currently, he's the writer for the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre and a number of other films that he's written that recently. They were supposed to go into production, but they, you know, everything with COVID. But, you know, he's been a great friend. There's been so many of these people behind the scenes that have helped me along the way with the film and the writing and just different aspects of production. That are, you know, these huge resources we have going into this, you know, the Weight.
Well, that's super cool that, you know, I mean, one, the work you've done over the years, just to be involved in the film industry and doing all these different types of jobs, all that experience definitely plays into the Artist and Olympian and the Weight. But also, you know, you've learned, like, from those two mentors you had at that one job, you know, them giving you extra time and really caring about you, I'm sure trickles down into how you treat people and how the environment's going to be on your set with your actors and your interns. So I think it's just a recipe for success. It's no wonder the Artist and the Olympian, which people should check out, is such an incredible short film. You know, like that, you could blow that up into a huge movie and let Donnie just go wild for 2 hours. But like, the Weight is going to be incredible. Like, it should be all over the world.
Yeah, well, it you know, it's, we're trying to explain to people is that, you know, the team I have also around me. So it's just to kind of recap. I was in LA for 2 years, and then I came back because I hated LA, and I went back to New York, and I worked on the show The Blacklist for around 4 years, and, you know, met more connections. That's where my producing team comes in. You know, in terms of trying to explain, you know, my world to the weightlifting world, it's gotten complicated. I'm trying to tell people, like, listen, I know this is $100,000 in Kickstarter, but this isn't the movie. This is a much bigger thing. You know, we have investors that we think just haven't put money in yet, and actors, big name actors, who people know right away. I can't mention anything because of NDAs. That will be in this film that are going to make it a huge thing on a public scale. You know, these are names that are going to get us into film festivals just by name recognition alone. So that's really where that's the importance of the Kickstarter. It's been 10 years and it's coming down to these last 20 days of my life where if this thing will get made or not. But my producing team, you know, we have over 40 years of experience working on major network TV shows and films and things of different, you know, very different budget levels. My one producer, Sean Nattini, just finished working on West Side Story, which is a Spielberg film. My other producer, Jackie Dore, she's one of the, I think the, she might be the youngest female first assistant director in the DGA's history. And she's been a first AD in Law and Order. She's worked on a ton of Marvel movies. My friend, another producer, Camilla Rothenberg, has a background producing in at the advertising world and is just, you know, connected, but also just one of these people who just, I always say, like, you always need that kind of schmoozy producer that is just championing your work, and that's Camilla. She's just a seriously awesome human being that has believed in me since day one, and she was actually the assistant for one of the executive producers and the production manager at The Blacklist. This woman named Laura Benson, who's also been a huge mentor to me, like, you know, Beth Mikkel and Russell, as I was telling you earlier. And she's extremely well-respected in the industry. Camilla would always go to Laura, you know, whenever I'd win, you know, screenwriting, you know, script awards for the script. Sorry, I'm running on 2 hours of sleep. My ability to talk is diminished. You know, she would champion it to Laura, and Laura really took an interest in me and had really guided me and Jackie and all these people, like my inner circle, you know, along the way. So those are the people that are behind us. I mean, big budget stuff run really well and effectively. That's going to help us extremely well doing something that's lower budget, because we're going to run it like, you know, we ran, you know, big $100 million TV shows, you know,
professional production. Everything we're doing right now with the Kickstarter is to fund all of that. And then this is just the base level.
Doing the Kickstarter was, we had it for a year. We've been in talks with several actors and a couple of this group out in LA. We're working with another production company to get these investors kind of commit that we've been talking to. And it's like, they like the story or something else. They're not really sure because it's a niche world. They don't understand the world. It's especially what made it a bit challenging also is when I committed to Zach, they wanted a bodybuilder. A guy that was into bodybuilding. He's a CW star. This was after they read the script, and in the script, there's an explicit scene where, like, we talk about, like, you know, he's with the doctor, and he's explaining to the doctor, he's like, I'm a weightlifter, and he's like, oh, is it, like, bodybuilding or powerlifting? And it's like, no, it's not. It's like, and finally, I think in the
script. I love that you have that specific scene in there.
Well, you kind of had to, yeah.
Yeah, everyone has experienced that when you try to explain to your doctor what it is you do, and you're like, no, I throw the equivalent of human beings over my head as quickly as possible.
It's actually very technical. It's not just I'm really strong. It's I'm really strong and really mobile and, you know, everything. It's a skill. You know, so they read the entire script and they talked about, like, bodybuilding. I'm like, no, it's a, like, Sean was on the call with me and he I remember he sent me a text. He's like, I can hear you cringing over the phone.
I think that just shows the importance on why the film needs to get made. Like, like a film like this will help people understand what weightlifting is and how bodybuilding is what people assume is everything, you know, but it's like there are specific niche, you know, barbell and strength sports. So a film like this is uber important. What is the premise behind the film? For people listening, what's the story?
So the story is about a weightlifter named Casey Murray. He's, you know, around 30 years old. He's kind of bitter, broken down. He's a guy that was a former junior world champion. His father is his coach. I mean, this is really a father-son story as well. I think that's, you know, other than the weightlifting world, this is really, you know, about human beings, like as all movies kind of should be. So it tells their story. So it's about him trying to make the Olympics one more time. And he's at a point in his career where he's seen the guys that he was beating in junior worlds take steroids and win gold medals. And he wants to take them. His father really does not want him to. But he's, you know, at 30 years old, that's an old, you know, and as a guy who was lifting when he was younger, that's a lot of mileage. So he's pretty broken down in terms of his body. And he's, you know, starting to contemplate, you know, retiring, listening to his dad, or taking steroids. He doesn't know which way to go. And that's when he meets this artist named Natalie. And she becomes kind of his muse, eventually kind of becomes a mirror to him. And that's kind of the basic of the story without telling you way too, you know, too much.
Yeah, yeah, we don't want to spoil anything.
It is an underdog story, but it's not a conventional movie. And I think when people think, you know, what sports movie is, a lot of the usual tropes I've subverted in the script. So if you think this sounds like a movie you've seen before, it's not. It's very different from, not just because it's a movie that has weightlifting in it, but just because of the structure of the film and, you know, the relationships and how we portray what I think is an intelligent athlete. I think that's what's very different about weightlifters and the sport of weightlifting versus, you know, there's other sports or like a boxing movie, is weightlifters are they're usually very intelligent. And there's a kind of Renaissance artistic side to it that isn't there in other sports.
Yeah, I mean, look at Donnie Schenkel. You know, he's probably one of the smartest weightlifters in the whole community. You know, he's big on philosophy and psychology, and it's like he's a very intelligent person. And look at his weightlifting; it's incredible.
Yeah, but that's one case. There's tons of other cases. You know, he's an autodidact. He didn't go to college, and then you have people that have like, you know, not only graduated but like have masters in sciences. It's, I would say, like, you find in weightlifting, you find two different types of people. You find like the autodidactic person who didn't go to like college for this, and then you hate the person who's like the PhD or has a master's thesis in something. Like, there's no real in between of like the guy who just went to college was like, I want to study business. You get both ends of those spectrums and very, very wide different personalities and different backgrounds within.
Yeah. Now, do you have I don't know if you can share any of this. So if you can't, just let me know.
Yeah.
Like I've been wondering, like, who's going to play the father? Like, what kind of, like, do you have like wish list of actors?
Yeah. That's our biggest role in terms of getting a big name actor. And that I would love, very much love to explain to people who we've been in talks with, and that I cannot. I think it would make my life much easier if I was able to. But I'll say this. It's very much, you know, the film Whiplash. I'm speaking to you, Zach is texting me.
What's up, Zach?
I'll tell you what I said. But good God.
He's like, I need you to be lifting now.
Yeah, and he's like, hold on, let me just, sorry about this.
That's all right. I imagine an older man for, you know, of course, for the father figure. My mind always goes to like, if I was casting someone, like an Ed Harris type of guy, because he's got that rugged look and he looks like he could have been an old weightlifter. Like he kind of almost looks a little bit like Mike Bergner. Like, if they're going to have a Mike Bergner movie, have Ed Harris play him.
It was, that kind of is our model. So you've seen the film Whiplash?
No, I've not seen that.
First off, I highly recommend it. It's a great movie. It's about a jazz drummer, J.K. Simmons in it, Miles Teller before he was as big as a name. You know, this kind of gave him his launch. You know, the guy who made La La Land, this was his first movie. And it was shot for around $3 million in New York City, which for us, our overall budget's around $1.162 million, which in Buffalo, that's about the equivalent in terms of your expenses and different things you have to deal with. You know, they got their money because they got J.K. Simmons and Paul Reiser in it. And Paul Reiser took a small part in it. J.K. Simmons won an Academy Award for it. I mean, the reason why big actors take these roles is because it's, you know, they don't have to worry about money, and it's something they really, really want to do. In terms of a part, it's a really good part for somebody. And I've always said the heart of the film is really you know, the father in terms of, you know, Casey isn't always likable. You know, he's a hard-headed athlete. You know, if anyone's seen the Michael Jordan series that came out, The Last Dance, Michael Jordan doesn't come off as a likable human being there all the time. And that's kind of where Casey is, you know, and there's reasons why he is the way he is, and further backstory, which, you know, obviously would, again, don't want to ruin anything. But it's funny you said, like, you know, when I was writing the script initially, you know, it came from me and my father. I think it wasn't until like 7 years after I wrote, you know, the first draft that I realized, I'm like, oh, that's where this is coming out of my psyche. But, you know, Mike Bergner, Kane Wilkes' father, his name is slipping my mind. You know, Jared Fleming, all the Ian Wilson's relationship with his father, you know, Ian Wilson and, you know, Mike and Casey Bergner, they were kind of initial definitely, you know, influences. Again, we're talking about how when I was writing, it was kind of about me, and I looked at those people to validate what I was writing about. They were definitely people I looked up to, and that I used kind of little pieces here and there.
That's pretty cool. When you're listing off those examples, I'm like, wow, that you could almost see like that, like the movie story kind of playing out in those scenarios, you know. Yeah. Not that any of those people have done that, but it's like the relationship part. You have a father and a son, the father's coaching the son, the father probably has some past experience in the sport. Yeah. And you know, I know for many, you know, there's so many future generations that are going to come up just like that as well. I mean, how many kids are growing up in gyms right now and their dads are like, I wonder, maybe they'll want to do this, you know, and excel at it. And even just on Instagram, I see, you know, Travis Mash has been training his son.
Yeah, he's 5 years old.
Like, that's super cool. So it's like, I feel like the cool thing about this movie is that so many people in so many different situations are going to be able to relate to everything in the film and be like, well, I've either experienced that, or I might experience that, or something like along those lines.
Yeah, I also think it's for, you know, someone who isn't into weightlifting, that's a connection, right? Like, family connects all of us. You know, either the absence of it or the difficulty with it or the love of it, it connects every single human being because, you know, it's what we all go through. It's part of the human condition. So I think that's something that people really, you know, when people in the film industry have read the script, that's like their number one thing that they love. It's the character, you know, his name's Gordon Murray, and everyone's favorite character is Gordon Murray usually. And it's because he's the kind of conscious of the film. You know, it's, you want your, and this is really something that every, you know, coach, father, you know, goes through. It's your coach, but you're also a dad. And in this sport where there's not a lot of money, and we know the situation with drugs, at some point, you know, the coach has to be, the dad part has to overtake the coach, and you got to look out for your son or daughter rather than the weightlifter. And I think, you know, this movie takes place in a time in the relationship where those two things are really clashing at each other. And that's, you know, what creates drama, obviously.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit, like, obviously not as dark, of a Million Dollar Baby, where you have this very dynamic relationship, and it just goes through these peaks and valleys on these two people. And at different points in that movie, one of them is likable and the other one's almost not likable, and they just keep flip-flopping. And so that's it's a pretty cool concept, and I think it's really important.
No, I do too. I mean, obviously I wrote it. And I think I've been working on this thing for 10 years. It has not made me wealthy. So there's got to be some reason why I'm doing it.
Well, I mean, you're dedicated. I mean, it shows how much you care and how passionate you are to spend a decade of your life getting it to this point. And you're not really filming yet. It's on the cusp of going there, and it just needs the support. More questions on the film. I'm assuming there's going to be a weightlifting meet or two in it, you know, like there'll be maybe a, like the sport aspect, correct me if I'm wrong. And then, how will that play out? Like, will you just run a weightlifting meet and have everyone go through the paces and film certain aspects of it? Will people just, go back and forth and just redo their attempts? And, will you be using real live weights in the film, or is it going to be all movie magic?
So, I'll try to answer one by one. They are there are 3/2 real competitions that we show where we have other real weightlifters. And that's, you know, we've announced a lot of these cameos on Instagram and our, you know, Kickstarter. That's really where these people are going to be playing.
Okay, cool.
I don't want to say what the competitions are because that would give away too much of where they take place.
Yeah, and but, I saw you have like Addison, who's been on the podcast. You have CJ, you have John North, yeah. Tom Stroka. So you've got quite the all-star list coming in.
Yeah, and we're trying to get many more too. I wrote it for, you know, that was part of the market. I wanted to do this before we were doing the Kickstarter. I was like, oh, we're going to get all these weightlifters to do it. Obviously, we're SAG, you know, film. We'll be non-union, but we will have a SAG affiliation, which means we have to use SAG actors. Obviously, weightlifters don't have the $3,000 to join SAG, but there is a clause called the Taft-Hartley Act where if someone is of special look or ability, they can be paid as a SAG actor based on the scale rate. So that's our workaround. That's how I get in getting all these people in the film, legitimately. And it's, we know, like, for me, it's a bit like Marvel movies, right? It's, if you're a true comic book nerd, you love, like, you're going to recognize every little Easter egg. But if you're not, you're still going to love it. And just because it's a great, you know, it's great storytelling or whatever. You know, if you're a weightlifting fan, you're going to know these names. If you're a fitness, you know, that's, we've added Juju Mufu and Tom Boyd and are going to make a cameo, you know, appearance. So there's a little something for, you know, it's, we got the real weightlifters and we got, you know, people who are big in the YouTube, you know, kind of fitness area. And you know, Meg Squats as well. So there's something that I think, you know, if you're a big fan of all those things, you're going to pop really hard when you see all those things, but you don't necessarily need to know that if you're just a general fan, but it, yeah. If you are, it makes it that much more special.
Yeah. It's kind of like you said, with the Marvel movies, when Captain America rolls out and the diehard fans notice the uniform he's wearing is of a certain type from a certain storyline. But everyone else is like, well, he looks cool, you know, and everyone enjoys. That's super cool. And I think, you know, it just adds that extra touch. It makes it feel so much more authentic as opposed to just having other people, you know, no names playing weightlifters, which there probably will be. But seeing CJ and seeing Addison and John and all these other people, it just makes people feel, you know, special. Like you'll feel even more prouder to have it in your collection.
And listen, like, obviously, I'm not just trying to add these to appease people. I'm, at the end of the day, a weightlifting fan myself. And then that's where this is coming from. Like, you know, the idea of like, oh, man, this would be cool if I got so-and-so in it. And, you know, getting, it's ironic because I had to fight with Zach, you know, for the investors to be kind of okay with Zach. But Zach, for me, gave me access to all these people that I kind of, you know, I'd taken a break really from weightlifting, you know, just working on the script and other stuff behind the scenes. But I, you know, I kind of lost touch a little bit with the weightlifting world just because I'm married now and, you know, I have a life and I was working 12 and a half hours a day, 5 days a week. You know, Zach kind of got me access to those people that I wouldn't have had. In terms of, you know, how we're going to film it, you know, early on I had this idea of like, well, what if we just kind of do, you know, kind of what the film The Wrestler did where they filmed in between an actual wrestling thing. You don't want to do that just because one, you want to control everything. It just makes it easier in terms of what you can do. You know, you want to control everything you want to be able to control. So you want to be able to light it the way you want, which is different for film, obviously, than lighting it for just, you know, a competition. You know, you need fan reactions. You need, you know, every little thing in the world you can imagine. We have to control. It's also can be a legal issue in terms of, you know, we have to film in a certain amount of days and filming in New York State, there is a tax incentive. That's why we're filming it. That's one of the reasons why we're filming it in New York State and why Buffalo, because Buffalo is considered upstate by the kind of film office, which we get an extra bump in terms of making it, you know, a good deal for investors. So, you know, there's a couple more reasons too, but that's the gist of why we're not kind of doing it guerrilla style. And just kind of film, like doing an actual competition. Like we also, I thought about actually doing competition ourselves and like awarding money and there's rules, like, you know, you can't really do something like that actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Turns out it's not fully legal.
There's all these rules that you don't like, you don't think about, like, well, why wouldn't that be okay? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it comes down to, you know, a lot of times it's money and different things like that. But, it is easier for us to control it. And you know, obviously we'll be picking and choosing. It's not like everyone's going to go up there and do three attempts. You know, it's going to go by the script of what I have written. So some things are meant to kind of show people off, you know, like I'm very excited to have Cheryl Hayworth and Jenny. And we're trying to get more people to Morgan King, Carrot Slaughter. You know, a few others to be in the film because I wanted to show off women's weightlifting. And so we're going to have them involved in the best way we can, which is, you know, in the background as coaches and showing them lifting, you know, even if it's not the competition, you know, it's not the weight class or anything. We just want to show it for like a quick thing to give, like, you know, showing the setting of what this competition is like. And it's like, you have all these different weight classes, all these different genders and ethnicities and everything else. And I want to be able to show that world.
And I think that'd be super important too, because like, if you show like Morgan King warming up in the back room, even if she's not going to go out on the platform for the film, but then you also see, you know, some of the other heavier weight classes and someone who's watching this, who has no idea what weightlifting is, they see all these different body types and abilities, and they're like, hey, I could do that, you know, like, or I want to do that, or, and they inquire about it. So you're helping to grow the sport with this film.
Exactly. So many ways. That's something we've tried to convince to people too, is like, this is going to help everybody. Like supporting this is supporting yourself in a lot of ways. You know, in terms of like the million-dollar question of like, how are we going to film it in terms of everyone's asking me live weights. And the way I try to explain it to people is, you know, in boxing movies, they don't actually punch each other in the face, or they're not trying to hit each other as hard as they can. They do hit each other because it looks more realistic, you know, but they're not, you know, you're hitting someone at 50% or something like that. And this is actually something, you know, in terms of, go back to my research with Glenn, this is something Glenn told me, which is that, you know, at the time I didn't realize it, the bar moves differently. If you really know what you're looking at, it moves differently when it's, you know, over your body weight, right? You have to pull back on a little more. The physics are different. So like that, in terms of like how much weight needs to be in the bar versus how much it looks, we need it to look like it weighs what it does. So it's got to be at least over body weight. So it's, we're using a mixture of real weights and we're essentially fake weights that we're, you know, doctor up, but it's still going to be, you know, and this is something we did on the Arsenal Olympian, which no one really knew. And I'm okay with saying now, Donnie didn't actually snatch 160 kilos. He snatched more like 135 or 140, which is still heavy as hell.
Yeah.
But you know, that weight moves and pushes you in positions that if you can't be in, if the weight's not enough to look authentic.
And you couldn't really tell, like it looked like 160 and he definitely sold it. And I would say too, with the artist and the Olympian, and this is going to be something that'll definitely probably happen in the weight, but the editing was superb.
You're going to make my editor Rick very happy.
Let him know, because shots, like going to the eyes and back and forth between the artist and Donnie and just both of them, their frustrations and what they're doing. And it was so well done.
It's this is another thing people realize in terms of like how much we meticulously plan that, you know, I storyboarded the whole thing, which normally I don't like storyboards, but because this was so, you know, there was no dialogue, it was no scenes really, it was all action based. We had to do that. We shot an entire short film before we shot the short film on video and tested stuff out to make sure that these edits were going to work and where the cameras needed to be and how long it was going to take. You know, everything, time is everything, and you have to be meticulously planned. You know, unless you have a bigger budget where you know you're going to have more time or you can do reshoots and stuff like that, if you get one shot at it, like we're going to get, you have to be perfectly planned, like rehearsed, and, you know, everything's got to be ready to go before you ever go. And it's, you know, that's something that's incredibly important. And that's the only way you're able to really do it, is just through this kind of insane rehearsal. You know, the word I've gotten Zach to say over and over again, a new favorite word I always say is refinement. You know, you don't want to get it to the, you know, there's in weightlifting too, right? When you're learning technique, there's an adaptation phase and then there's accumulation phase. Like in the beginning, you're just learning, you're adapting to being in those movements. And then once you kind of learn it and once it's, you know, neurologically processed, then you're accumulating strength and all that stuff. So it's the same thing. It's not about getting, you know, filming 10 takes and getting one good take. It's about filming 10 takes, getting five good takes, and you know, three mediocre takes, one great take, and one take where something really special happens that you didn't plan on or something like that. Like, that's where you want to go. You want to get to that point where you're just refining.
Yeah, that I love the analogy on equating it to lifting. I mean, it's pretty much like that's how everything is, you know.
Yeah, that's,
you gotta
that's
refine that's, all your skills.
You know, there is a montage in the film and that I think is really, you know, it's my big set piece in terms of what I can artistically do. And I think it's a montage in a sports film that no one's ever seen. And a lot of it plays off of kind of something I learned in neuroscience called neuroplasticity about it's essentially how we learn as human beings. You know, we create synapses in our brain. You know, when we're younger, like chemically, you build a synapse. And then once it's built chemically, then it becomes electronic. And that's what muscle memory is, right? If I were to ask you, what was the name of your fourth grade teacher? It would be?
It was Mr. Ludwig.
Okay. Now it's, you know, that is electronically, you know, in your brain. If I were to ask you again, what was the name of your fourth grade teacher?
Mr. Ludwig.
See how much quicker you answer that? It's because it's already learned. You're just prime, like a muscle, you're just priming it. So now that it's there.
Bringing it to the forefront.
Versus, you know, when you learn a new skill or anything else, there's that big confusion period. And what that confusion period is your brain adapting to what it's going to and chemically creating new synapses.
And what's weird right now is like, I mean, I'm not trying to do it, but like I have all these memories now, fourth grade, flashing through my head.
Yeah, it's the mind is a very fascinating thing. But, you know, that is something that is once again, I'm trying to make this too over, it's subconscious stuff. And a lot of what filmmaking is, you know, it's like an iceberg, right? 10% is of what you're watching in a movie, you're kind of actively paying attention. 90% of what a filmmaker is doing stuff to you subconsciously.
I like it. I'm excited to be subconsciously immersed in this film. A big part of a film for me that really draws me in is the score, the music of a movie. What are your plans for that? Are you having original music created, you know, John Carpenter style? Are you going to be doing it? Or do you have people producing it for you, custom songs?
It's right now, I mean, that's still a little bit ways off in terms of a composer. There are certain songs that I absolutely 100% know I want to use in the film, and that we're trying to, and perhaps some of this Kickstarter money that, you know, if we get it, would be used to kind of acquire those, you know, licensing rights first. There's definitely,
because songs are expensive, right? Like if you want to play a Whitney Houston song or something, you're going to pay an arm and a leg.
You know, I can tell you from, you know, cause I've seen the deals, you know, to get it on a standard network deal for, you know, like a big, you know, any popular song is around 40,000 per episode. So it's obviously being an independent film, like we could try to negotiate a little lower. You know, we're trying to go lower, and a lot of it's, you know, some of it's music I discovered. You know, there's around three songs in the film that I definitely know I want, that we're trying to get for, you know, maybe on 10,000 or 20,000, and hoping they're nice to us because we're a low budget film and they like the project. That I want to use in terms of like the score itself.
What are those songs, if you can say?
I can say, you know, because he recently passed away, Ennio Morricone, who passed away. There is a song that he did in Untouchables that has been remixed and done. I found it actually, this group, this kind of hip-hop group in, I think they're in Denmark or Sweden. It's kind of like pop post-punk. They remixed one of his songs, and I know I definitely want to use that at the end. Listen to the Music by the Doobie Brothers. I definitely want to use, and Pavarotti's Nessun Dorma.
I love this variety too. Like those are all fantastic songs.
Yeah,
and it's very sad that he passed away too.
I mean, he was 91. I mean, he's the greatest ever. But
yeah,
it is sad. But you know, he left the world. You know, his legacy is secured, and he gave us the world a lot of stuff. What was I going to say? You know, in terms of, you know, the way I've always viewed, you know, the kind of the themes of the movie, it's operatic in a way, right? There is that aspect to it. So the music will reflect that, you know. Also, you know, the way you know, my favorite filmmakers have used music, it is not just, it's not just a supporting thing. Some of it challenges the audience. Some of it's ironic. Sometimes it's funny, the relationship. You know, Stanley Kubrick is my favorite filmmaker of all time, and I would say like he's the North Star, because if you really know what you're talking about directing wise, like you realize why he was so great. And one of the biggest reasons is the way in which he used music and different music than people were expecting, and interacted it with the audience. So that is something to keep in mind in terms of, you know, kind of what we'll be going after.
Yeah, I know when I'm watching a film, you know, there was a film that came out this year or earlier in the year. It was the Color Out of Space with Nicolas Cage. It's an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation. Mm-hmm. And one of the most memorable things, and I immediately went and found on Spotify, was the score. And it just, it adds so much weight to a scene when the music and the emotions of the music come and they get to a crescendo. I butchered that word. I couldn't imagine that scene without that music. So I'm super excited to see what you guys do in this. And it's definitely going to be on my Spotify list. It's great. It's always great to listen to that type of music too, the instrumental music when you're listening, when you're lifting.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in this film, and I think it's all going to be very, very interesting for people. And it's, there's obviously a ton of stuff that goes into making a movie. And that's something I want people to understand, but it's what I also want people to just really understand is obviously it's, just in terms of the importance of the Kickstarter, it's nothing happens unless we don't get this money. If we get this money, we know that I've knock on wood, you know, because nothing is real until, you know, contracts are signed. Basically, I've been almost assured that we will get the rest of our budget that we need. But, you know, we've been talking with these guys for over a year back and forth, and it's a chicken the egg situation. As I mentioned, the Kickstarter video, I'm running out of ideas in terms of how to do this. I know that if we can raise this money, you know, $100,000 for, you know, what is they consider a niche sport or niche interest in the middle of a pandemic with the protests happening at, you know, 10 days in, you know, that speaks, incredible volumes of the marketability of the film. It also gives me creative control, because now I get to say, my production company has put money into this film because we raised money on Kickstarter. You know, it gives me creative control to be able to say no to people, which is a extreme privilege.
So important. And it's so important, yeah. Too, because, I mean, you hear stories about how a director had a vision and someone else steps in and they do the safe route or what they think people want to do. It'd be the equivalent of someone who comes in, like you said, doesn't know weightlifting, and they just completely morph it. And everyone who's a weightlifter is like, whoa, what happened? Like, this isn't our sport. This isn't what we do. This isn't our culture.
It's Hollywood bullshit.
Yeah. It's the same thing with like when they change a superhero, you know, and it's like the fans are like, whoa, why in the world is Peter Parker doing this? This is not that character.
Yeah.
But it's some studio exec is like, well, I want it to be this way for my grandkids or something. It's like, well, what about the fans, you know?
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, kind of screw your grants. No, but they do, like, you know, the Justice League. I go nuts at fanboys, because fanboys will complain about stuff like Justice League, and then they'll go and pay money and see it and make it profitable just so they can go crap on it. It's like, if you don't see it, you get better films. You control this by with your money. And it's like,
I've only recently started boycotting films, you know, like the Justice League was what sparked me to boycott the latest X-Men movie, which was a disaster. And it wasn't until I was in midway through the Justice League where I was like, something wrong is happening. And I've never felt this way during a movie before. And I'm like, I don't know if I should be here right now. This is not at all what I expected. And actually, you know what I felt? I felt lied to.
Yeah, that's what can happen when there's too much, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen, and studios are worried about making it what they think is profitable and what works to audiences. And this has been my whole theory on filmmaking and what how to make it profitable is, great films always make their money. You know, bad films like Justice League and other stuff can make money by, you know, kind of fluke and just interest. Great films, whether or not they bomb at the box office, eventually, either on demand or something like that, always make their money. Like Shawshank Redemption was a bomb at the box office. It's now thought of as one of the greatest films of all time. There's a number of stories like that.
John Carpenter's The Thing.
Exactly.
My favorite movie of all time. Misunderstood when it came out, but now it's cult classic.
Exactly. It's something that, you know, that is my philosophy, and that's has always worked. I'm like, if I can make a great film, that's all I'm really concerned about, is trying to make a great film. People will be interested. I think that's what people really are interested. They just want to see a great film, and it doesn't matter at all what it's about. If the filmmaking is done right, people will love it and want to see it. And that's something that people who, and you know, I can go into the whole history of Hollywood and, you know, who runs that now, and how little they understand about movies versus, you know, back in the day. Obviously working conditions are better now, but they don't treat actors like slaves like they did back in, you know, the early days, where they had these crazy contracts. But you know, it's you get a chance with this film to really see something you want to see, and that's a rare opportunity in life. You know, it's skip the Starbucks coffee or something like that. You know, it's times are tough. I'm currently unemployed. I'm waiting on, you know, my unemployment paychecks for the last 5 weeks, and stuff's hard. You know, with everything going on, I'm still giving money where I can, and, you know, in the bits I can, to different things I think are worthy causes. So if this is something that interests you, you know, $5-$10 here goes a long way. And that's we'd also want to show these investors, it's like the high number of people pledging.
Yeah, you the know, individual.
The individual to say that this audience exists, even though it's outside of Hollywood, so you don't think it exists. It exists, and it's very vocal. You know, once again, the guy they wanted, he was a CW star that was into bodybuilding that they wanted. Zach has more Instagram followers and 100,000 YouTube subscribers in terms of marketability that guy does not have. You know, and they think, but he's an actor and he's been on TV. They think he's more marketable, and it's like, not necessarily.
Yeah, not to me. I mean, the fact that Zach is in it and he's a weightlifter, and you know, like you can run into him at any of the AOs or a meet and whatnot. It makes it more personable, and that makes me want to see it all that much more. Yeah, and I think it's super important that you're a fan of the sport, and that's going to come out in this film. And everyone listening right now, it's all of our responsibility to support this film. If you are a weightlifter, if you're a powerlifter, a strongman, a kettlebell athlete, a CrossFitter, it is 100% all of our responsibility to help this film happen, because if we don't, films like this won't happen. Yeah. And you'll just keep watching football movies, keep watching basketball movies, whatever it is they make, Air Buddy Soccer. You know, like we need movies on weightlifting and less movies about dogs playing soccer. You know?
Yeah. Hey, Air Bud 2 is pretty fantastic. Now,
yeah, I remember when that movie came out. I'm actually a fan.
Hey, they're adorable. You know, it's hard to argue with having a cute animal on screen. It just sells. But no, it's, you know, I feel it's, if you don't contribute to this and you complain afterwards, oh, I wish weightlifting was more popular. I wish my parents understood, or my family, or my girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever it is, understood and had more empathy for what I'm doing and why I love it, and you don't support this, you can bitch, but there's no validation to your bitching, because you've had a chance to contribute to something that's going to make it more relevant and bring people outside of weightlifting understanding this world.
And you know, this film gets made, and now you can sit down with your family and watch it and be like, this is what I do. I mean, like, not all the little acts in the movie, but like, you see this meet, like, this is a part, this is the community I'm involved in. And speaking of the community, is USA Weightlifting on board with this? Have they been spoken to? Are they going to promote
it? Yes. You know, it's a little iffy there in terms of what they can do in terms of as a governing body. You know, it's, in terms of, you know, there are more of a reason for us to go about rights and likenesses and stuff like that's where the issue is there. The you know, in terms of supporting it, we might be going on the USAW podcast. So it's kind of dependent on if Phil Andrews is okay with it.
Come on, Phil.
You know, they put this way, USAW, I don't believe, can expressly say, you know, fund this, you know, try to fund this movie. At least I don't think. But what they can do is you know, once the movie's out, they can say, hey, watch this movie about weightlifting. You know, it's, we also, another thing I'm not allowed to say yet, but I can kind of lead you to it. There is someone who's going to be providing all the equipment in the film, and it's a big name, which everyone will recognize. Those people are contributing to the film. That's where, you know, the idea of product placement, of using authentic things that real weightlifters use and real equipment and real supplements and things like that, you know, that, that those things are going to be in the film as well.
That's very cool. And I really hope, I mean, they need to get you on the USAW podcast, at least to talk about it and draw attention. You know, the more audiences you get in front of, the better, obviously. And then, you know, I really hope USAW, you know, does their part, you know, because we're all part of the community. And I know there's going to be limitations, but it would be great to see. Because I know, like myself, I've been kind of wondering, I'm like, I wonder why they haven't posted anything about it yet, you know, because for me, it kind of feels like it's everywhere, you know.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they also have a number of things on their radar, you know. I'm not sure if you've noticed, but there's a pandemic, and
it changed
the Olympics. We're supposed to be watching the Olympics right now, and we're not.
Hey, we're gonna watch the weight instead.
yeah, exactly. So it's I understand how busy they are right now. I would, you know, a repost would be nice.
Yeah, hey.
I'll say that a repost of a little thing would be nice, because you know, there's a lot of USAW members. Some of them are older and have a little more money to, you know, spare too. So I wouldn't mind it for that reason as well.
Yeah. See, just a repost. Now on the film, it might be obvious, but like, why did you settle on the title, The Weight?
So we've gone through a number of changes, of the title. Like at one point it was also going to be called The Artisan Olympian. For a long time it was The Exalted. It was, then it was just Exalted, and then it was Lion Killer. And then I came back to the weight. It's something I was like, it's too obvious. And then, you know, you grow old, you know, growing with this thing for 10 years, you grow older and you realize all the different meanings. When I say the weight, it has multiple meanings. It's about, you know, obviously the addiction to lifting weight. This guy love, you know, it's his relationship with the barbell and that addiction. It's also the weight of the choice. He has to, you know, the weight of kind of, you know, there's a subconscious thing about, you know, manhood in the film and challenging that, and you know, expressing different ideas of male toxicity and things of that nature. So it you know, could be analogous to saying the weight of manhood or something like that. You know, it's about, at the end of the day, in simplest terms, why the weight is, because it's about lifting the burdens off your shoulders.
That's fantastic. That makes total sense. I think that's the perfect title. Like you said, it's multifaceted. There's so many different ways to take that meaning, and it just adds so much more depth. I'm excited for this movie.
Oh, well, good. I hope everybody is, because it's I can honestly tell everyone this and not feel like I'm overblowing it or just trying to convince people. People are gonna, whatever you think this movie can be in terms of, you know, quality. This is very brash to say, I'm trying to make the greatest sports movie ever. I mean, I think that's my mentality about it. And, you know, that's a scary thing to say and to say out loud, but that is the truth in the way I'm looking at it. So it's what I hope is people look at it and say, oh, this isn't just a movie that is interesting because it's about a sport that I'm in, or this isn't just a really great sports movie, but this is just a really great movie that has shocked me for every single reason why people watch movies. What it's about, the way it's done, the acting, the writing, the relationship with music, the way we block scenes, the camera work, every kind of single thing you use in the filmmaking toolbook, we're using, and using it to create something original and unique that people have not seen before.
And I think that's, you know, I think you hit it, the nail on the head right there. It's, you know, there's so many movies come out, like low budget movies, where you can tell there's no soul in this movie. There was no care. It's just getting it done. And you wish that maybe some elements could have been better and the director cared more, producers cared more, the actors tried. But I think if The Artisan Olympian is any indication on what's to come, this is going to be on that level. Like you're right. It's almost like that's like a teaser, right? On like what can be done and the atmosphere and environment.
Yeah, that was the Artisan Olympian. The reason behind it was kind of, for me, it was a directory, I call it director show-offy piece. You know, I think me and my DP and my matter Rick, their joke with me is, oh, it's my camera porn movie, just because the way it's shot. And you know, it's very, you know, it's just purely visual. Something I haven't said, this movie is extremely cinematic in terms of, you know, using, you know, it's, I pray to God we get a theatrical, we'll get a theatrical release, and that's, you know, that's X, Y, and Z, and we're on A, B, and C in terms of the plan. But it'll be, you know, in terms of also theaters opening up again, it'll be incredibly cinematic in terms of the viewer, you know, viewing it. It's a very extremely visual movie. I think it's also why the investors and stuff like that haven't really understood it yet, because I think it is something you have to see to understand. And I think once that happens, people will get it implicitly. I think they'll feel it in their soul.
Yeah, like when I think of like a visual toned atmosphere type of movie, I kind of think about like Joker, where it's like every scene you're caught up in, and the colors are just right in every scene, and there was no wasted moment in that film.
Exactly,
you're just like this the whole time, just like, I can't believe what's happening right now, like in every single scene.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot. I've explained to Zach, I'm like, we call it shot economy. You know, the number of shots you're using to film a scene, but also earning every single moment, every single frame you have to earn. Nothing's taken for granted, and nothing's ever easy in this business too. Like every single thing you see on, you know, that's within that frame has been purposefully thought about, talked about, you know, changed, tried to make sure it works before an audience ever sees it. And it's, if you don't do that, you're not doing your job. Like you were saying, how it's interesting that, you know, I always find it funny that people find it so interesting that like actors or directors do all this research before. I'm like, I don't think that's exceptional. I'm like, that's the job. That is your job.
Being a coach.
Yeah, my job is to research and make this authentic and make it interesting and entertaining, and challenge the audience. That's not me being exceptional. That's me doing my job.
Yeah, and I think you've got the right attitude about it. Like you said, you're trying to make the greatest sports movie of all time, and like I want you to say that. It's almost like if you have a coach, they're like, I'm in this moment, I'm trying to be the best coach there is. Like if I go to a weightlifting meet, you know, there may be other coaches there, but I'm trying to be the best coach in this room right now for the one person, two person, or people that are with me. And they deserve that. And whatever your craft you're doing deserves that level of input. You know, whether you succeed or not, you should be trying. So I think that's just, you have the perfect attitude for this. You're a fan. You've got the right attitude. You've got the community around you. We just got to keep building it up.
Thank you very much. Speaking of trying to building it, I do have to go just because I have to get back to Zach because right now he's my second wife and I'm his second wife.
Well, do you have time for like a couple 5 minutes for a couple rapid fire
questions? Yeah, absolutely.
So real quick here, I got all these things that like my brain was pouring out. In terms of a director style, like for yourself, you know, there's like Christopher Nolan, I saw recently, he says he uses no chairs. He doesn't want people to sit down. Kubrick was very psychological on some of the things he would put people through. Do you have a specific style like that that says this is Adam?
That comes out through, you know, there's two examples of style. You know, like there's Tim Burton, Wes Anderson, where their style is becoming almost a shtick, like they're almost a parody of themselves.
Yeah.
Kubrick, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, Robert Altman, like people like that, you knew when you were watching their movie, but they changed it up every time. And it's really customized to the story and everything being told. You know, there's certain things of the way the lenses I like to use and the block, you know, certain blocking things that become kind of, you know, Kubrick had a certain look that he would, you know, they call it the Kubrick glare. Like there's certain things like that I do that are more subconscious and more, which scares me because we're living in a time where you can't be subtle, but they are subtle, and on purposely subtle, so they don't take away, but also so you know it's my film.
So these are like your signatures, kind of like J.J. Abrams uses a lot of lens flare, or Martin Scorsese, his mom was in a lot of his movies.
Exactly. Like, so for me, it's, you know, Kubrick was known for loving to use a 14 millimeter lens a lot in certain kind of tracking movements. You know, for me, there's, you know, this is my first feature film, so I haven't had done enough stuff to really have that kind of record, but I do like to use, I think something I do is, I will always kind of have a long, like one take shot, tracking using kind of a wide lens, but then I'll also have something that's a set piece that's cut very quickly together. And I like using macro photography. It's a hard thing to answer because it changes. I don't believe in style. I believe kind of more in, you know, your style and everything else is dictated by the story you're telling and the way you're telling it. Anything that is me is kind of subconsciously there. Yeah. I don't purposely put it there. It's just kind of, it's based upon what, you know, the filmmakers I've watched and loved and what my interests are and what I think is interesting that is just part of who I am that comes through it. But I don't think I really have anything that is, that I would say is a distinct style. It changes from the actor, from the situation and all that. You know, there's certain things I like to do photographically, that may be different. Like I hate, Michael Bay's, you know, the whole thing about, you know, teal, everything's, you know, teal and orange. Like I hate that.
Yeah.
But you know, in certain lighting techniques I like more than others. And tracking shots, like I like to move with the character as you know, the character is moving. But I don't know necessarily what you would say is my distinctive style.
Well, maybe you're still growing into it too. The more projects you do,
it changes and evolves as you change and evolve as a human being too, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Well, now, the name of the show is The Barbell Strikes Back, which is obviously a play on The Empire Strikes Back. Speaking of movies, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite Star Wars movie out of the bunch, or are you a Star Wars guy? Not.
I know it. I'm not, because I got in. I mean, I've seen them all. I got into Star Wars late. I was like, I think 11 or 12 when I first watched A New Hope. And then everyone's got guilty pleasures. I actually don't hate the prequels as much as everyone else does.
Really?
There are certain things that I think are awful, but you know, it's for some people it's religion. Like I imagine you love Star Wars. It's basically a religion.
The world was ending when the last one came out for me. So yeah.
Yeah. The last one was good. It was definitely felt like an ending, but it was god awful. Do I have a favorite one? I mean, The Empire Strikes Back, I think as a movie altogether, I think that one's probably the best. I actually love the fighting in the prequels. I think the fight scenes in the prequels are actually pretty awesome.
Yeah,
And entertaining. At least, you know, the lightsaber battles. Like there's certain things I love about, you know, the episode three where it becomes Vader.
Yep, Revenge of the Sith.
Revenge of the Sith is such a mixture of an awesome movie and the worst effing movie I've ever seen. Like like my one buddy says, like the problem with those movies is no one said no to George Lucas, and which is absolutely correct. But it's a mixture of these great scenes, you know, like the opening scene that, you know, Revenge of the Sith is awesome. But then you have scenes with like Padme and
Anakin
and Anakin and Obi-Wan that are just so cringe inducing. It's one of my favorite moments of that movie is Ewan McGregor when he has to say Anakin killed younglings, and he's like this, and he looks like he's just trying to be like show his, you know, sadness. He couldn't stop laughing when he said the line, because it's such a ridiculous thing for a human being to say. Which brings me back to another point about movies, actually, which is, you know, if me and Zach talk about this, I'm like, I have to remind him, like, what's the most important thing a movie has to be? And he was like, authentic or whatever. Interesting. A movie has to be interesting, which means it's better to be either incredibly good or incredibly bad than it is to be mediocre.
Yeah.
You know, look at the Disaster Artist or the Room. That movie is, in Con Air actually is a bit like this too. It's so bad, it's good.
You know, I can't get enough of Con Air.
Yeah, like Nicolas Cage's accent, that is so terrible. but it's also so good because it is so terrible. Like, that's the most important thing. The baseline thing for what a movie has to be, that I would say is the only thing that is required, it has to be interesting.
100%. And I feel like the wait is going to be interesting. I can't wait. Most important question, tell us about the Kickstarter. How do we support it 100%? Where do we follow and track all of this? How do we follow you? Let's do it all.
All right. So let's see. We have at the time, we have around half an hour, we're going to have 20 days left to do this. Right now we're at $30,000. I think I'm hoping right now that it actually might've changed as we're on the podcast. I think it's actually, I've known a couple of people told me that they're going to donate some money. I think we'll be at 40,000 pretty soon. We have to get to $100,000 by July 29th, by 12:58 or 12:57 in the afternoon. That is our cutoff date. They only take your money if we reach that goal. They do not charge your card until we reach that goal. So it will be July 29th again at 12:57 p.m. You can go to Kickstarter and search The Wait to find it that way. The best way probably is to follow us on Instagram at The Wait Feature Film. And you can click the link in our bio to then lead you directly to the Kickstarter. You can also check out thewaitfeaturefilm.com. And you can also check in, you know, follow Coach ZT. You can follow me on Instagram at AR Shiner. We are trying to be everywhere and anywhere. but those are the two places. You can go to Kickstarter directly, you know, directly, or you can go to the Instagram or Facebook page, or you can go to the website. Those are the three best ways. And it's, you know, I think people are thinking, you know, oh man, it's, it never really happens with Kickstarter is everybody waits till the last minute. And I'm trying to plead to everybody, do not wait till the last minute, because I know even saying that, everybody's going to wait till the last minute, or at least half the people are going to wait till the last minute. But I also know that people are not going to donate the last minute if it's not close to being a success.
Because yeah,
you find it with Kickstarter, everybody wants to come in the last minute. When I raised money for the Artisan Olympian, I think we were 30 or 40% with 3 days left. And we did a Reddit AMA with Donnie and Glenn, and we got it in 2 nights. Like, it can happen like that. So my thing is, if we're around $50,000 to $60,000, you know, by the end, last week going in, I think we have a really good shot of doing it, but we can't get there unless people are donating now. And once again, it does not charge your card until, you know, the July 29th end date, and only if we meet our goals.
You know, when you said everyone's waiting for the last minute, that's just like being a coach and trying to get people to sign up for a weightlifting meet. You yell at them blue in the face, like, hey, did you sign up for the meet? Oh yeah, I'm gonna. And then it's the day of the cutoff, and that's when they're doing it.
I'm trying to get a hashtag going that says don't wait for the wait.
Oh, that's perfect. Let's do that. I'll put that in the show notes. Now, everyone who's listening, Adam, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me and letting me ramble for a while.
No, I've loved talking to you. I've loved hearing about the film and the film industry and everything you have to say. Everyone who's listening, it's our responsibility to help make this happen. We want this to happen. This is good for us. This is good for Adam. This is good for everyone involved. We want this to help us to continue to grow this sport that we love. Again, whether you're involved in weightlifting, powerlifting, strongman, CrossFit, it's our responsibility to do this. I've donated. I'm on Kickstarter. I've learned all about it. It's very simple to do. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the link to the Kickstarter on the Barbell Strikes Back Instagram page for the link in the bio. And I'm going to leave it there because I don't have a website. So I'm just going to leave it there until the Kickstarter is done. So hopefully people will come by and support that cause. And guys, remember to follow me on Instagram. I'm going to post about this again. I'm going to share it. Please, 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 if you enjoy this show and anything that you've heard over the last 26 episodes, you know, normally I ask you just to follow the channels and to maybe leave an iTunes review or 5-star rating. All I want in the world is for you to support this film. It's that important for all of us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again, Adam, for coming on. And thank you again, everybody, for listening.